Welcome to Pain Talk, where we explore pain through a modern, science-based lens. If you're a healthcare provider or someone living with chronic pain, this podcast is for you. We break down how pain really works, why it can persist, and what helps the nervous system begin to feel safe again, because pain is real. But so is change.
Today, we're exploring one of the most challenging and emotionally charged questions in chronic pain care. Do spine injections and procedures actually work? Or do we sometimes hope they work more than the evidence suggests? Many people living with chronic pain or neck pain have been offered treatments such as epidural steroid injections. I mean, there's all different types that I'm sure Dr. Oh, that's the other thing. Is it Dr. Bussey or Bussey?
Bussa.
Bussa. Oh, my goodness. Okay, there you go. I was trying to figure out how to pronounce that. Bussa. So for some patients, these procedures can be life-changing, obviously, and it offers some real relief, even if it's temporary, and sometimes restoring function when other treatments haven't actually helped at all. But recently, a 2025 guideline published in the British Medical Journal, reviewed by the highest quality evidence available to us today, was published. This guideline panel led by Dr. Jason Bussey and colleagues concluded that for many people with chronic non-cancer spine pain, these procedures appeared to provide little meaningful benefit beyond placebo and recommended against their routine use. Now, before we go any further, I just want to make this clarification. It's really important to state clearly this conversation is about research and evidence, not about telling people to stop treatments that may be helping them. Research looks at patterns across large groups of people, but individual experiences can vary. If you're receiving a treatment that helps you, decisions about your care should always be made in discussion with your healthcare provider. So to help us unpack this complicated and important issue, I'm joined today by Dr. Bussey, professor at McMaster University and director of the Michael G. DeGroote National Pain Center. I hope I'm saying that right, too. Dr. Bussey is an internationally recognized researcher in chronic pain and evidence-based medicine, and his work has shaped opiate prescribing guidelines and pain care around the world. And I would even argue that most of his work has been transformative for me as a clinical practicing physician who works in multiple areas where pain is often, you know, experienced, although pain is probably one of the most common experiences that patients will reach out into healthcare. But certain areas can obviously be more complicated, especially around the chronic pain and pain at the end of life. So what happens when science raises questions about treatments that many people feel has helped them? It can be really hard to have these kinds of conversations. So what we're going to do is talk about it. That's a long introduction. I apologize. But I wanted to make that clarification. So, Jason, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation to be here, and delighted to provide any information or insights that I can from our recent work.
Yeah, and I'm hoping to tie some of it, because for me, I'm going to look at it through my lens, and obviously you're going to look at this through your research lens, and sometimes the two can kind of collide, because obviously what we're seeing at the clinical bedside can be very different than what actually the evidence is telling us. But I also myself have tried to understand this and also to help patients understand, you know, because it is incredibly common to be receiving treatments for chronic pain, to have those treatments stop working. But oftentimes patients are kind of stuck because healthcare professionals have not been able to provide them alternatives to these therapies. And so they're really scared to give these things up. And that goes with opioids as well as with these procedures. It doesn't mean that we want them to give them up initially. We want them to be able to bring in some other tools, but they need certain pieces of information to be able to get there. It's very hard to let something go when nobody's been offering you anything else. Yeah, so hopefully that will come across as we go through this. So I'm curious about what made you first interested in studying spine procedures and chronic pain.
So I was really sort of asked to get involved in the topic at the time by the chair of my department. And I had sort of limited knowledge. I hadn't looked into it to any great extent. I had helped out a colleague who had wanted to publish a survey based on patient experiences. So it's observational data. And in general, patients reported large benefits, at least in pain relief. Yeah. They reported large benefits. They, in general, had not been able to return to work. There were quite a few patients that were off work receiving disability benefits. But the subjective impression that they had in general was very positive. So that was my only foray But we do know from work we've done in other treatments for chronic pain that non-specific effects can be large. And so one of the conclusions we made in that paper was the treatments, in this case it was nerve blocks for chronic spine pain, appeared to be quite promising. But because it was based on observational data, there was a real need for randomized controlled trials to try to disentangle how much of this effect was specific to the intervention and how much was non-specific. And non-specific effects are completely real. This is not about patients in any way, creating this relief. This is relief that they experience. But again, we know from many, many other interventions that with chronic pain, there does tend to be a non-specific or a placebo response and then a specific response due to the treatment itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you're highlighting a really important thing. And even though most of the tools we use to quantify pain in the clinical setting are really tools that actually try to measure and I'm just going to use an example like pain scales, right? Pain scales basically are a objective tool that measures a subjective experience, right?
Absolutely.
Because pain is because I also think that what it does, it keeps the clinician as well as the patient kind of stuck in a biomedical model because we start to get very focused on structures. Right.
Yes.
So I think, some of the tools that because how we experience pain, I think sometimes we forget is that pain is really an output. Right. It's really a reflection of our threat landscape. So, threats come from our biological landscape. And I think that's where most of these tools actually can be very effective sometimes. But there's a reason why they stop working as well. I mean, there's lots of reasons why this starts to happen. But what we're not really good at, because most of our measurements and objective ways of looking at pain keep us stuck in this biomedical model. But what we're not good at measuring or even including in this, which I think is more meaningful, is how these therapies are actually improving the quality of life for patients, meaning are they becoming more functional? Are they becoming more connected? Are they more engaged? So the sensation of threat might be coming down, but the impact or the value of those treatments can't really be measured in other areas. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it makes a lot of sense. And there's a group called the Impact Group, and they're an international collaboration that has been informing what patient important outcomes should be captured and reported in clinical trials looking at treatments for chronic pain. And when we looked at interventional procedures, for example, we found 132 randomized controlled trials. So there is a decent literature base there, at least in terms of number of trials. You can certainly draw concerns about the quality of some of those trials. And we know from the impact work that we would like to see seven patient important outcomes reported, not just pain, but sleep quality and social functioning and role functioning. And of course, we need to know about adverse events. And when we looked across these trials, only three out of those seven critical outcomes were reported by at least half the studies. So almost every study reports on pain, but there was no other outcome that was reported by all of the trials. So there's a real limitation in terms of the literature being able to tell us about how effective interventions are on outcomes other than pain. And again, pain is critically important. If you ask people living with chronic pain, what is a critical outcome for you? They will inevitably mention the experience of pain itself. But as you alluded, people also want to know, how well is this treatment going to help me sleep? Will it let me get back to work? Will it let me engage with my family? Can I travel? So there's other things beyond pain, and the literature in many cases does not provide us with a lot of great answers on those other outcomes.
Absolutely. And I think so if you had your magic wand and said, okay, if I had to develop the ideal trial that could really help us answer this question, because I think what's important is that your trial, what you've been able to do is to say, with the evidence that we have, because you've made kind of a strong statement is that we're not recommending, right? So, and I think that's where people get a little bit kind of antsy, especially people that are like patients that are using these therapies, but also the clinicians that like, they don't know what else to ask patients or to offer patients, obviously. But if you had the ideal trial that you could design that could actually truly measure the benefit or the value to the patient, what would that trial look like?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I should clarify, we made a strong recommendation against use of the procedures outside of clinical trials. So we're certainly quite enthusiastic that people will design and conduct better trials. And I was at a meeting of the American Academy of Pain Medicine this past weekend, and I was asked the same question. Because again, a lot of our discussion, it was a panel discussion, a lot of physicians that perform these procedures and have seen substantive results in their practices. And again, wondering why are these results that I see so often in my practice not being reflected in the existing literature when they are explored in clinical trials. And so what I advocated for there and what I would advocate for here is I think that the clinical community would be well served to choose an interventional procedure that they believe is particularly effective. Choose the patient population that they perceive is highly likely to benefit from this procedure. Choose the best interventionalists out there to deliver this procedure and come up with some standards about how these procedures are going to be administered so that they can clearly convey to readers that they have been done in a manner that best reflects current understanding of optimal practice. Capture all the outcomes that are important to patients. And what I would also suggest is engaging with a group of methodologists who will then run and analyze the data to remove any perception. We all have unconscious biases when we're exploring things, especially if they're things that we feel very passionately about. And I include myself in that entirely. And so it's important to have those firewalls when you're doing a trial to ensure that the interpretation, collection, and analysis of results are not influenced in any way. And then again, I would also ensure, sufficiently long follow-ups to understand, not just are these procedures producing some benefit in the initial, hours or days after they've been received, but how long does that benefit extend to? So those are sort of the basic parameters that I would suggest for putting together a compelling trial.
Yeah, so it's really important. I think the other thing that we forget is that people who have a lived experience of chronic pain, I mean, this has been life-shifting for them. And oftentimes, I know the population that I tend to see in I'm sort of at work in a multidisciplinary clinic around pain self-management. So using tools primarily around some of the work around the psychological tools like pain reprocessing therapy. I don't know if you've had any reading or experience around that. It's just, for me personally, it's been transformative in the care that I've been able to provide. Not that I'm sitting with patients for, 15, 20 minutes doing pain reprocessing therapy, but even the approach and the understanding of how this particular therapy can help to kind of impact patients' pain experiences just in my everyday work. It's really, truly, from a clinical perspective, been very transformative in that patient who's been ready. And I mean, we even have some evidence in some populations that it can actually even reverse or minimize completely their pain experience. And I think it makes sense when we think about it, right? Because I'm just going to kind of put this out there, because for me, this is how I understand it, Jason. And I try and get patients to understand this, because we're hearing about different therapies. We're hearing about, because I get asked every day, and I'm sure you do too, what do you think about a chiropractor, Dr. Allen? And I'm like, well, my question really is not what about a chiropractor. It's about how safe a chiropractor feels to your body. Because it's really important to understand the threat landscape of the patient. And so how I explain it, and I don't know if this will make sense, but I'm going to put it out there. so it can, because I think the conversation can build around this, is that if you think about, this is not to downplay or minimize the pain experience. Obviously, it's very personal and very, very real for the person experiencing it. But if you can imagine a smoke detector. So a smoke detector has one basic function, and that's really to pick up smoke or fire. But that smoke and fire is not the loud noise, right? Those are just the threats in the environment that the smoke detector has been designed to pick up. It has to actually be processed by that smoke detector before it gives you that loud noise. And our brain in many ways works the same way, but our threats will come from, you know, these tiny sensors that we have in our body, our nociceptors, right? But it also comes from the central nervous system. And parts of those threats are really, I like to see, think of them as those multidimensional aspects of how we experience pain, right? Because pain is not just a physical experience. You know, it's a multidimensional experience, and our treatment should really be based on that. And so the output is actually pain. And that output is really based on how much threat that person is experiencing. So when we have in the system, you know, most of our treatments I find are still very focused. I mean, I've been in healthcare for 40 years and we're still focused on that biomedical model, you know, but research like yours, as well as even the work you did with the opioids, I mean, they've literally transformed. I mean, as a physician who works in palliative care as well, to me, they made so much sense, especially when your initial guideline was looking at 200 milligram morphine equivalent, because that's when I do all my opiate rotation. Patients, mm-hmm. you know, in my palliative care population, because it's not working anymore, right? So, and there's lots of reasons. It doesn't have to be the patient. It can be the pathology. It can be other threats that are there, but it also can be the drug itself, right? Which is causing opiate-induced hyperalgesia, right? So that's still a biological threat. But so understanding the threat landscape of that patient doesn't mean I shouldn't keep focusing on biological threats, you know, to make sure that they're okay, but we have to be able to shift to those other threats if we're going to actually help that patient, you know, make any progress. And so we know that these tools cannot be in one basket. It cannot be a medication basket or an interventional basket. It has to be so much more. But we, I think, as a healthcare community, sometimes keep patients stuck because the biological manage the tools that we use to manage those biological threats are much more accessible to patients, but they also make patients feel cared for. So if you look at something like an intervention, like one of the comments you made about how a lot of clinicians find that these therapies, patients will tell them subjectively that they improve mm-hmm. their health. Well, it makes sense to me that they would do that because they're getting attention to the issue, right? They're getting somebody actually paying attention to them. They're getting treatment, which is truly benefiting. But the problem is it may not be dealing with the other aspects of how they're experiencing that pain or that suffering. And then when we tell the patient, well, there's nothing more we can do, then we've abandoned them. So that's another threat. And if they don't have a family doctor, which most patients don't, then we're in trouble, right? This patient is just left hanging again. That's more a threat. So yeah. I'm just curious about your thoughts about that. And
yeah, you've touched on a large number of really important topics. So I might not recall them all, but to go through a few of them, I mean, talking about the issue about abandonment, for example, we recently surveyed close to 800 people with chronic pain in Canada, asking them about their care-seeking journeys. And what we found is, you know, these are people that were living with chronic pain for many years, in some cases decades. And by the time we surveyed them, more than half had sort of abandoned the healthcare system. So at the beginning of their journey, they were seeking care from everyone and they tried everything. And it was almost this desperation. And there were a lot of dead ends or things that seemed to work initially, but then stopped working. And it was quite astounding to us to find that, you know, the majority of these patients had essentially disengaged from the healthcare system. So it is a problem, and I think there are a lot of individuals that end up in this sort of place. You talked about the role of a lot of the interventions we have that work wonderfully for acute pain. They are just magical for acute pain. And honestly, anyone that's had a dental procedure, anyone that has gone into labor, they will extol the astounding benefits of an interventional procedure or a nerve block or an epidural steroid injection as you know, incredibly effective. And the challenge has been, to what degree can we sort of think of chronic pain as acute pain that lasts longer, and in which case those same therapies that work so well for acute pain should also have a similar benefit for chronic. And it makes sense to explore that, but there's been sort of repeated lessons over time that chronic pain does appear to be a different animal. It is not just acute pain that is going on for a longer period of time. And I think that's the reason why some of these therapies that work so well with acute pain have not seen the same sort of magnitude of effect or benefit for chronic pain. And when we talk about chronic pain, people often try to put it into buckets. they say, well, do you have neuropathic pain, meaning there's been some sort of damage to the nerve? Or is it nociceptive pain, which means it's more to do with soft tissues, your ligaments or tendons or muscles? Or is it nociplastic pain, sort of central sensitization, things like fibromyalgia, for example, where we don't see sort of a clearly identifiable lesion that's causing it, but the person is in a great deal of pain nonetheless. And those buckets tend to blur. And over time, even if someone starts off with a pure neuropathic injury, going down the road, you know, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, it tends to get a little bit more blurry, and it tends to sort of move into other categories. And so what the large organizations are trying to conceptualize right now is this idea of chronic secondary pain, where you have a clearly identified disease or lesion that seems to explain it well. You know, an obvious disc herniation, it's pushing on this nerve, you have sciatica, you know, you can do provocative tests to make it worse, or you can do things to make it feel temporarily better. You see it clearly there on your imaging, for example. And then we have chronic primary pain, where the person is truly in a lot of discomfort, they truly have a lot of limitations, they do feel chronic pain, it is 100% real, but we don't find a clear, obvious physical generator for that symptom. And when you look at something like chronic back pain, which tends to be probably the most common chronic pain complaint, and they do studies to try to divide people into these two categories, the studies that I've seen have found that between 85 to 90% of patients coming in with chronic back pain fit into that chronic primary pain category. The pain is no less real. It is absolutely real. But it is not going to resolve easily with a surgical procedure or something that is targeting sort of a biological cause. And so then you get into therapies that, instead of trying to deal with, you know, these sort of, you know, peripheral mechanisms where you might, you know, block a nerve, for example, they try to deal with the more central processing, things that you mentioned, pain reprocessing therapy, which is, you know, quite interesting. And what it talks about is, We can get into a state where our bodies become very hypervigilant, as you said, and they sort of overinterpret signals that are coming in as extraordinarily painful. It's more a matter of trying to sort of modify how we're processing those signals. And in some cases, it seems to be tremendously effective. So there has been a randomized controlled trial of this therapy. It involves meeting with a therapist roughly about 8 times. That's what they did in the trial. They enrolled quite a large number of people with chronic primary low back pain. And at 1 year, they had about a 60 to 65% complete recovery rate in the intervention arm. Quite astounding. And one of the most powerful sort of, you know, stories that I've heard to sort of help explain how this is possible came from a TED talk that was done by a neuropsychologist. I think he's in Australia, and he lives in the outback. And he was talking about how he, you know, would love to walk down his little sort of forest path to go to a pond. And he'd often just have, you know, his sandals on and a bathing suit and a towel. And one day he was walking down to the pond and he felt a little scratch on his ankle. And so that's a real signal. And it traveled up his leg and it went to his brain. And the brain has to then interpret, what does this mean? And the brain said, well, I know we're in a forest and there's lots of like sticks and brush, and I probably just scratched my ankle on a stick. And he didn't think much of it. He walked on. Anyways, 10 minutes later, he was in a coma. Turns out he'd been bitten by an extremely poisonous snake. He was lucky to survive this. You know, his friends rushed him to the hospital. He had the anti-venom. It was a terrible experience, obviously. Anyways, some weeks later, he's again walking out to his little pond in the back to take a swim. He feels a scratch on the ankle. Signal goes up to the brain. This time the brain says, you almost died last time. It was a horribly poisonous snake. He pulled his leg up. He screamed in agony. He looked down and it was a stick, right? The same sensation, but the way the brain was interpreting it, it was entirely real both times, but it had a very, very different response. And so the idea about trying to understand if someone's coming in with a chronic pain complaint that is due to a disease or a lesion that we can address quite well through the biomedical model. Maybe they have rheumatoid arthritis and they need a biologic, or they've got a herniated disc and they, or spinal stenosis and they need decompression. These things work wonderfully in the right patient. But it does seem as if we have a large number of patients that are not going to have that sort of clear cause and effect pattern. And if they are more of a candidate for sort of this sort of reprocessing type therapy, it would be wonderful if we could identify that and then help them sort of explore those therapies. But you talked about one other thing as well, which is the patient ready? Is it something that they are willing to look at and accept? And one of the things that we have not done a good job at with research, and I think to some degree with our communication and healthcare, is trying to present this sort of messaging to patients in a way that is not stigmatizing. And the unfortunate reality seems to be when we talk to a lot of people that live with chronic pain, they very much find it acceptable to have, you know, a tumor, a broken bone, an infection, something that you can point to and say that's what's causing it. And when you start to get into discussions around how the brain might be interpreting sensations, that can sometimes feel dismissive. And so we have to work better at that so that we can engage people in treatments that are most likely to be helpful. And if someone's not ready for it, we have to respect that as well. Give them time, let them explore that, and then revisit to see if they're maybe open to it at a future point.
Yeah. So who you're talking about is Lutermere Mosley. I think he's an Australian physiotherapist. Yeah, fascinating stuff. And so that we used to use that, actually, that case, because it is well documented in the literature, but it's really an amazing part of how we understand how the brain is changing and adapting always towards protection and survival. So you bring up a couple of things. And one of the things that I think is really important is that, in my experience, so there's going to be two things that I'm just going to pull out of that and see what you think of this. But it's never been about motivation or willpower in my work with patients living with chronic pain. They are the most motivated population you could ever work with. People are getting that wrong. Just because they're not trying to walk, you know, just because we assume because they're not walking 15 minutes twice a day, that means they're not trying. When in fact, that is a really totally misrepresentation of what we understand about what's going on in their pain system, right? So it's not about motivation. It's not about willpower. It's what I call skill power. It's about understanding what is actually going on in the nervous system, what these changes are, and also the skills that are going to be specific for it. And another great example in clinical practice to think about where it gets very confusing and blurry is when we think of type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Right? They sound like the same. They're about insulin. They're about glucose. But if I take the tools that I'm using for type 1 and apply them to type 2, I'm actually going to make them worse. I can actually even do more harm. And the same thing works the other way. So these are, they sound the same, but they're completely different biological mechanisms that require very, very different approaches. And even the markers we use to quantify whether somebody's making progress is going to be different for each of them, right? So, mm-hmm. But we try to put them into one bucket, but that never works. It never fails. And so we're not looking at other things that might be happening. And just one other thing that I think is so important, Jason, that you're bringing out as well. I do think that we do understand in some ways what's happening, you know, to patients' nervous systems, because I mean, I feel like I'm in this. I can't stop thinking about this stuff all the time, which is why I love doing podcasts. Because you do, I mean, as a healthcare provider, we want to have an impact at the bedside. We want to see people have quality of life, right? We have one chance at this life. But from what my reading is saying and what I'm understanding, and it makes total sense, is that, you know, when we're experiencing acute pain, it makes sense that we're going to need therapies. We're going to probably not move as much. We're not going to, you know, we may use medications, you know, until our body's healing, because we have an expectation that it's going to go away. But the more we start to avoid movement, especially when the pain starts to extend, we start to see those changes, those pain-generating neural circuits, which we're starting to understand more can be tied into those adverse childhood experiences, those learning experiences, you know, that are really designed for protection and to talk about that threat landscape, right? So this is not even about pain. It's about the threat landscape that's changing and adapting around survival and protection through no fault of the patient at all. The output is pain. But initially, what starts to happen, especially when we see these changes early, is that patients will develop something called hypervigilance, where their body, and this is often due to exposure. So I like to think of that as the first hit to the nervous system. And then what happens is they get a very significant painful experience that comes into their life. And what happens is that the brain latches onto that sensation because it is such a powerful, important sensation that our brain wants to give us to get us to act and do something. Mm-hmm. But what happens when we start to use the tools that we normally would use for acute pain is actually they start to promote the development of these pain-generating neural circuits. So when you look at things like fear and avoidance of pain, so not only is the threat landscape changing, the output of pain actually starts to become a threat to that patient as well. So the sensation of pain starts to kind of create this feedback where even the sensation itself can be terrifying, right? And then we start to link other things to the pain sensation, like you know, if we're becoming more deconditioned and we fall, you can start to develop fear of falling. Right. So, And then they get more. So it's a vicious cycle. But I always try to separate out into the threat landscape, which is going to be unique and distinct for every patient. The easiest thing I can do as a healthcare provider is focus in on that biological and try to think of treatments. But when they're not working, it's probably because many of these therapies actually promote fear and avoidance. And it totally makes sense to me when I think about the opiate guidelines and I think about the interventional tools, because I know my patient is motivated. I know I'm motivated. I want to see them get better. It's not about the motivation, but what is the skill that I'm teaching that patient about how to live with this very complex condition? Is that skill more fear and avoidance? Am I reinforcing those pathways? Or am I helping patients actually feel safe with the sensation? And that's where it gets kind of crazy, because then people are like, what do you mean safe? Why should we feel safe with pain, right? Because intuitively it doesn't make sense. But in fact, the pain reprocessing stuff, there's a really nice paper by Elliot Weiss out of Canadian Family Physician, which actually we now view tools like PRT at level one evidence. So they're bringing in some other trials as well. So I'm not saying that it's going to be easy, in fact, but what they've done, so what's amazing about technology, here we are looking at technology, is that we can actually provide the ability of the patient to access these tools online. We know that 80% of people will get their information from a book or from online. They don't get it from, you know, sitting with a healthcare practitioner, believe it or not. It's mostly they're very motivated, right? Yeah. So Pain Canada has some great stuff. I don't know if you're familiar with some of the resources that they have, but just even starting to look at some of this stuff. So I think even though we feel helpless in the clinical setting, there are, you know, meeting that person where they are, you know, are they somebody that needs to explore this? I always tell people, don't stop looking for treatments. Don't stop looking for biological treatments or interventions. And in fact, you embrace anything you can find. But here's what I want you to do. I want you to actually expand that landscape to start bringing in other treatments that may actually be more effective for addressing this mechanism, which is what we call chronic pain. Chronic pain and acute pain are totally different, right?
Yeah. And so again, you bring up a lot of really interesting areas. I'll share one anecdote that was sort of very powerful for me. It was someone that I went out to see. They'd been on disability for many years with a chronic whiplash complaint, a young woman, mid-30s. And what was interesting when we were talking is, you know, she'd had what seemed to be a minor car accident that resulted in long-term disabling pain. And some years ago, she'd been in a very, very similar car accident and presented for acute neck pain, but it didn't result in chronic pain. And I wanted to understand that more. And so I asked her, I said, tell me more about this, because I'm trying to understand why a similar situation the first time seemed to resolve, but the second time it didn't. And she said, well, the first time I hurt my neck, I had a family physician, and they'd been my family physician since I was a baby. They knew me. They understood me. They had a very strong relationship. They did their exam. They did some sort of limited testing. They said, you know what? I know it's very uncomfortable. You have had an acute injury. This is not going to be sort of a permanent thing. I'm going to give you some sort of general over-the-counter medications to help with some of the pain and muscle stiffness that you're feeling. And, you know, it's good to sort of get back and sort of resume your normal activities, as you recover. And they did. And the next time they had a car accident and they had a similar neck pain, that family physician had retired. And they had a new family physician. And again, they were, I'm quite confident they were excellent and well-trained, but they really wanted to do a lot of testing. And they said, well, I don't see anything on x-ray, but we're going to get an MRI. I don't see much there. Well, maybe there's a few little things, but, you know, we should do some nerve conduction. Well, maybe this. And it was quite fascinating because the more they did this sort of testing, this individual said, what's going on? What's happening now? The last
threat
time
landscape.
I had this
threat landscape.
Threat landscape. The last time I had a similar injury, I got very limited testing and I was sort of told to sort of go forward. This time I'm getting more testing and referrals and sent for more imaging and nerve conduction. And they got very concerned that something might be wrong. And the more that we sort of test people, especially when we do imaging, we find a lot of things that may or may not have clinical significance, but how we interpret those becomes quite important. And the difference in the clinical encounter seemed to be very important in terms of establishing the prognosis. The first time, someone that knew her well, limited testing and reassurance seemed very effective. The second time, a lot of testing, a lot of referrals, a lot of advanced imaging kind of seemed to send a different message that there seems like there is something really wrong. I got to be careful. Hurt equals damage. I have to guard it. I have to protect it. I shouldn't move it. You know, and by the time I saw this person, this was 2 years into their sort of complaint, they were still wearing a neck collar.
Oh, wow.
You know, 2 years in, because they were again, completely legitimate. They believed that they needed to have this on because if they felt discomfort, it meant damage was occurring. And so because of that, it very much changed the prognosis. So I think the nature of the clinical encounter, how the sort of nature of the injury is communicated to the patient, can have a really big impact in terms of how they end up doing. And again, the other challenge I'm going to sort of state, and this is a little bit unfortunate. So I was at a talk recently at the Canadian Pain Society last year where Howard Schubner, who is one of the pioneers of pain reprocessing therapy, was giving a talk. And I said, I want to hear him talk. This sounds very interesting. And as part of his talk, he mentioned his contract with his hospital had not been renewed. He'd been let go.
Oh.
And when he asked why, they told him, because you're not making us any money anymore.
Yeah.
And he was very... He was very disappointed by this reaction because, you know, as we've said, there are trials now that have shown sort of large effects, but it takes time to do this, and doesn't fit well into sort of the traditional healthcare model. You know, patient comes in, you often only have 10 or 15 minutes with that person. If you want to spend an hour, it's hard to sort of make that work within the current system, and maybe more so in the U.S. system where there's, you know, more pressures on that area.
Yeah. You know, and I think you highlight a couple of things that are really important, because as healthcare providers, we feel that when we give a patient a diagnosis or if we over-investigate, then somehow they're going to take that information and feel reassured that we're taking them seriously. And that may be true at one aspect. But generally what happens is it actually creates more fear. So when you give someone a diagnosis, say, of degenerative disease, mm-hmm. which we all know is a normal biological adaptation that happens as we get older. In fact, yeah. I'd argue that degenerative disease, these backs are actually stronger because of how our body lays down extra bone. Yeah. You know, you can look at it different ways, right?
Yeah.
But so what it creates is this feeling that I've got this horrible illness that now I have no control over. So we've actually taken away the patient's autonomy and we've given them no other... Because so I sometimes will use degenerative disease as a way to help the patient understand how chronic pain is probably infiltrating that, right? Mm-hmm. So if we look at the treatment of degenerative disease, what's the treatment? It's get active.
Yeah.
But what happens with chronic pain is that when you try and get active, so if you didn't have a biological adaptation of that nervous system, you probably could be sent to physio, you know, physio would get you moving, or you could even just start moving on your own. You don't need a physiotherapist. But when you live with chronic pain, often movement actually will trigger more pain and our brain yes. Learns to avoid it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So that's how you can actually link chronic pain into how this may be something more than just a structural a normal physiological adaptation that might be happening. And Jason, that, you know, I think we need to understand how the language that we use to describe conditions for patients is so impactful. I mean, you use something as simple as a disc rupture, right? A disc rupture is terrifying. If you Google it, I mean, that pries on our negativity bias alone, right? We're going to go down that path. And patients are like, holy shit, you know, and if you start to, sorry, I don't know if I can swear, but I'm swearing. But then if I say to the patient instead, yep, you've got an injury to your disc, but we know that there are things that we can do to help that, to help you while this injury heals, and things that you can do to promote movement, right? Because a ruptured disc doesn't mean you are doomed, you know, to severe pain over time. So how we frame the communication becomes really important, because what we're doing, if we can just imagine that we're increasing threat, you know, for the patient's brain, how they're going to process that and make, because our brain wants to make sense of what the clinician's saying. I don't want to ask too many questions because they're going to think I'm really dumb or I'm afraid to ask this question. But their threat landscape is actually creating a picture, an image. They're also creating, they're hanging on to these words. It's no different than if I give a cancer diagnosis. And then the brain is creating threat around that, neurocircuitry around that, and primarily what it's going to do, which it'll do for all of us. Someone with chronic pain is no different than the rest of us, is it creates a protective landscape around protection and survival, because that's what it's designed to do. And the only way your brain can get your attention is to give you more pain. If there's more threat, that means more pain, more protection. Less threat, less protection. So I think our words are very, very powerful. There's one other thing, I know your time is pretty valuable, but there's another thing that is, I just think we sometimes forget, is really important. And this is coming back to the biological threat system, is that our body has very natural and normal ways of responding to pain that can be very helpful when you have acute pain, but become very problematic when chronic pain happens. Because now what's happened are these protective mechanisms have become habits. Right. So when you think about the normal response, so our brain is designed to make us pay attention. It's like the smoke detector. And if we're not paying attention, it'll make it louder. It'll find another way to get our attention. Right. If it feels that we're under threat. So immediately our body's response is muscles are going to try and stabilize those painful areas. Right. They get tight. Our body moves away from pain. So it's this thing I call the pain tuck, where people start. I see this all the time in Emerge. You can see so much about what the pain experience is for that patient just by how they walk and move. And so when we tuck forward, obviously we're changing our center of gravity. That spine is carrying an extra 60 pounds of weight, right? Because we've kind of changed it. But also that weight is being carried on our hips, thighs, and knees. You need to do a study. I keep saying this over and over again, is I want to see a study that looks at patients who started off with back pain and now have hip and knee pains and have hip and knee replacements, because it is so predictable for someone who's in the habit of moving a certain way, using their body a certain way, that they start to see wear and tear in other areas. And often it starts with, you know, back pain. Like you say, we're coming back to back pain again, being the most common. So I say to patients, we're not trying to change whether or not your muscles stay tight or whether your body is adapted. What we want to do is change the message. We want you to understand why those pain sensors can actually start triggering more pain. Triggering more threat. It's not necessarily pain yet. It's how your brain is processing it. And it's linked that increase in pain to that sensation of body burning, which is really most times muscle work, you know, and often how you can make that connection is to lay down and things ease off a little bit. But we want to change the narrative. So I don't want families, because oftentimes I'll have that discussion with patients and the wife is sitting there or the husband is sitting there. And I said, I do not want you to nag them to stand up straight. Okay. That's not what this is about. Because that's not what we don't want to put more intensity or more threat on people. Yeah. What we want to do is change the narrative or increase their awareness of how their body is adapting and moving, because most times they don't see it. Most patients, it's insane to me. I remember this one particular case, and then I'll be quiet, but it was a patient with significant trauma in her past. And, you know, she had done a lot of work. So she was in a really good place by the time we saw her. And so I always like to look at how, you know, the movement part. So, and you look at the bottom of their shoes, that'll tell you a lot about how people are moving. Well, she literally had the toe part of her shoes were worn out. Her heels, she didn't even touch the ground. And I said, you know, you're just kind of spending most of your weight on your toes. And she says, no, I'm not. That's not. I said, well, let's just have a look at your shoe. And to me, it made sense, because she was with her trauma past, she was in a fight or flight response, right? I got to get out of here. So her body had adapted to that position, but it's so telling. And we had a great laugh because it was just, I'm like, yeah, she goes, oh my God, I would never have known that. I said, look, I don't want you to fix it, but it's kind of cool to think about how our body is so ingrained around our protection and survival. But obviously that has some consequences long term. So
yeah. No. I mean, I completely agree. And maybe I'll sort of draw a parallel a little bit with some of the work we've been doing looking at acute trauma patients. So I work with a lot of orthopedic surgeons here at McMaster that do a lot of fracture repair. Yeah. And that is a serious major injury. Yeah. People don't expect it. They are rushed to hospital. They often require surgery, might have to have a rod put in. And what's interesting is that when we look at these patients, people that have undergone surgical repair of a long bone fracture, could be in the arm, could be in the leg, we see that at about 1 year, 50% of those patients will still report moderate to severe chronic pain, very, very high. And, you know, surgery or an injury, you don't know who it's going to happen to. But what we have been doing is, soon after someone has that injury and then they undergo surgery, we've been administering a lot of questionnaires to try to capture all kinds of factors that we can then look to see, well, what of those seems to predict who develops chronic pain and who doesn't? Because half the people do and half the people don't.
Yeah.
And what we have found again and again and again is individuals that are sort of more catastrophic about what their injury means soon after it's happened, more concerned, they have sort of a greater fear of movement. If they endorse these features soon after they've had their surgery, they are about five times more likely to develop chronic pain. Now, what's interesting about this is, it, in a way, you can make sense of it. If someone's had a terrible fracture and they've now had surgery, and it's good, everyone's going to be in a lot of discomfort after that, everybody. But how do you interpret that? Does it mean that the area is weaker, that you have to protect it, that you shouldn't move it, that you should favor it? Does hurt equal harm? If you believe that, then you're not going to use it and you're going to guard it. You're going to protect it. Those muscles are going to get weaker. Those ligaments and tendons are going to become less sort of functional for you. And then even to do less will now hurt more. And so it becomes this vicious cycle. And so what we've started to ask ourselves is, can we reverse this? Can we target these very understandable reactions to this very serious injury in a way that allows people to start to use that injured limb again, to give them reassurances that, if anything, the surgery and having that metal rod put in is going to make it stronger. It's not more likely to break again. It's actually less likely. And yes, of course it hurts. Of course there's discomfort. Of course you need sort of an immediate period of time after the injury where you should rest it and you shouldn't do a lot with it. But it's actually going to help you in the long term if we can get you using that again and sort of break out of that sort of negative cycle of hurt equals harm, protect, don't use. Now it becomes less functional. So we're starting to look at this. And there was a great randomized controlled trial published in The Lancet about a year ago, where they looked at a large group of people with acute low back pain, which, if you've ever had it, can be incredibly painful. I mean, just incapacitatingly painful. And they randomized them. One group got usual care, and the other group was engaged with a physiotherapist who got them started in a reasonable period of time into a plan of graduated walking. You know, nothing, no weights, nothing too high intensity, but let's get out. Let's start to normalize movement again. Let's get you walking. And the group that did that walking was far less likely to have another episode of low back pain over the course of the trial. So there seems to be something to this. I mean, yes, people need to have, diseases or injuries ruled out that might not make them a good candidate. But for many people, it seems they are a good candidate to start to re-engage in functioning. And if you can encourage them and give them the confidence to do that, they often have a better prognosis in general. But again, this is challenging. Yeah. It requires discussion. It requires conversations. It requires time.
Yeah.
And that's always in short supply in healthcare.
Well, but yeah, I'm going to come back and I'm going to say there's lots of things we can be doing. I mean, we have to shift some of the things that we do because sometimes our language can be so important in how we approach things. So one of the most common things that I do in the emergency room when somebody comes in with acute back pain is I basically tell them I want them to get a walker. And so they look at me with six eyes, right? Because it's about promoting safety with movement. I mean, you're still acknowledging that that experience is significant to them and it is hugely transformative. And I always tell patients when you come into an emergency room, already your threat level is going to be high because emergency means threat, threat, threat. But you try and promote movement that feels safe. What's really important if you're using pharmacology is that pharmacology is really about making that pain more tolerable, but the brain still, you normalize pain. Pain is there to protect the tissue. But what I try and minimize is people couch surfing, you know, doing those things. I just want to come back to one thing that I think is really important when you talked about catastrophizing, Jason. A lot of these behaviors or a lot of these personality traits, I guess we could call them traits, catastrophizing, worst case scenario thinking, people pleasing, perfectionism, those are traits that we develop usually under the age of 18 and often reflect our trauma landscape, right? Or our, I shouldn't say trauma, because not everybody has to have trauma to obviously get chronic pain. It's really around your adverse childhood experiences. So catastrophizing is a habit or behavior that we develop. Now, sometimes we learn it from a parent, right? That's how we deal with illness, is that we go down the rabbit hole. But patients or humans also have this tendency of negativity bias, so we can learn that pattern. You know, worst case scenario thinking is definitely, or sorry, people pleasing personality or people pleasing and perfectionists are all also habits and behaviors that we can develop at a very young age around certain types of threats in our spaces. Right? There is one interesting thing. I don't know if you've ever heard of Dr. I'm sure you've heard of Dr. Gabor Maté. He does some amazing work around, trauma and addiction. One of the things that he kind of highlighted in one of the TED Talk, actually it was a TED Talk as well for me too, so was around sensory processing sensitivity. And I thought, oh, this is a thing. And apparently it is a personality trait, but it's felt to be more genetic. So 1 in 20% of a population, so 20% of the population will actually have this trait. And it's actually been linked to an increased risk of chronic pain as well as substance use disorder. And that's where the individual processes the environment in a very different way. So they often are people that feel things very deeply, often don't have a lot of resilience around the tolerance. You know, you could say that that's also something that we develop depending on the environments we grow in, but I found that fascinating. Now, that's not to be confused with sensory processing disorder, which is what we see with autism, but sensory processing sensitivity. You know, you and he, where he used it in the podcast was around the higher incidence of suicide because of how people perceive their environments. And but it's also been linked to substance use disorder as well as to and it's not like, for me, all of this stuff is about awareness, right? It's about increasing awareness and you know, being able to kind of make those linkages. Because I don't know about you, but I definitely have tendencies around perfectionism and people pleasing. And I'm thinking, okay, where did I get those? I think most of us in healthcare have that, but I'm very grateful that I developed it. But sometimes you can kind of hit a wall, especially when patients really don't want to, they don't want the information. So you kind of learn very quickly that not everybody is going to be as enthusiastic about it as you are, kind of thing, right? So, but yeah, these are traits that we develop at a very young age.
And I'd also like to acknowledge, you know, as we learn more about sort of neuropsychology, there is often a biological component to all of this as well. And I've been really encouraged by some of the changing dialogue. You mentioned, you know, substance use disorder, for example. And I can remember, you know, going back 10 years ago, 15 years ago, where having an addiction was almost viewed as a moral failing. You know, someone has made bad choices. And we now understand more and more that there is a physiologic, a biologic rationale for this. This isn't just someone making bad choices. This is someone who is wired in a certain way that makes them predisposed toward these conditions. And again, you know, we have to find a way to sort of understand these processes so that we can explain them to people in a way that, you know, one, it makes sense and it's real. And it doesn't make the cure worse than the disease. We have to find ways to communicate these things in a way that they are understandable and acceptable and they make sense.
Well, you know, and bringing that part up is really important. So we know that there are brain pathways that chronic pain addiction share. not because it means you're higher risk for addiction, but often what patients who are living with pain do is they crave pain relief. The way I always frame addiction, because the population who is using opioids to manage pain is very different than the brains of populations that are using opiates to manage pain are very different than opioids they're using for whatever that other benefit may be for that other population. And the most common thing I usually hear is that they give them a sense of safety. That's what usually started them in the first place. Mm-hmm. So that safety may be just a disconnection. It can be whatever that patient believes. But the way I always try to frame opioids for patients in particular, especially those who are using pain, they're using them for pain, but sometimes they can actually have other effects because we know they can have other effects. Mm-hmm. So what happens though is what makes them an inefficient tool is not because they're not an effective tool, it's because of their pharmacokinetics. They stop working and you need more and more to get the benefit.
Yes.
And so what starts to happen, if you look, 90% of all addiction will happen under the age of 40, 85% under the age of 18. So if you've got a brain that is very neuroplastic, and you're bringing in a substance that gets repeated, it takes months to develop addiction, but when it develops, it's a life-threatening complication. It's not a moral or ethical failing. Mm-hmm. So my job as a practitioner is to protect that patient from that life-threatening complication. We always think of respiratory depression, but people don't see addiction as a complication. It is a complication. If you're Absolutely. Using, just like if I was using an anticoagulant in an elderly patient who's 95 or giving them a thrombolytic for a stroke, if I do the CHAD2, the HERS scales, you know, I'm going to find that that risk is super high for that patient to have a life-threatening complication, which is bleeding, right? It's no different with addiction, except the population is much younger when we introduce this therapy. And so we have to kind of, we get caught up in, because pain, I think it's more around the suffering. It's more about that moral piece that we kind of forget that pain is just an experience, right? So what we need to be able to do is to not feel intimidated to have these really important and difficult conversations around these therapies, especially therapies that carry some risk for the patient, even though they may be beneficial. But we have to be realistic and protect the patient from that risk if they have those big risk factors, right?
Yeah.
So you know, just tying into that, the opioid piece, but yeah, addiction is, like I said, is a life-threatening complication, and it's not a moral or ethical failing. I don't know how we can stress that enough for people, is that people who develop addiction are really good people, that obviously their brains are kind of their brain is craving pain relief. It's not craving getting high. That's another misperception about patients who develop that complication from the medical use of opiates. They're actually craving pain relief. They're not craving getting high. And in fact, when they develop the addiction, it's not even either one that's driving the brain. It's actually get me out of withdrawal. Like, keep me out of withdrawal, because you're in that survival mode, right?
Well, and again, all these are such great topics, and we could go into a lot of details.
I know, I'm gonna let you go here soon.
Yeah, but
I'm gonna get you back.
But just sort of quickly, you know, when we embarked on doing the first opioid guideline, just before we released ours in 2017, the Centers for Disease Control released theirs in 2016.
Yeah,
and it was a bit of an unusual document, but. And I can get into that at another time, but one recommendation they made that was very, very clear, they made a strong recommendation. They said, thou shalt not prescribe more than 90 milligrams morphine equivalent per day for chronic pain. But they didn't make the distinction whether that was for new patients or existing patients. And the reality is there were lots of patients with chronic pain that were receiving higher dosages than that. And some colleges, including some in Canada, made that a
standard. And Nova Scotia.
Made it a standard of practice. That means they can actually come after your license if you're caught contravening that. And the reason they did this is because there's an association with greater risk of harms at higher doses. So they said, we want to mitigate that by keeping people at lower doses. But the unintended consequence was you had a lot of people that were receiving higher doses that were shut down overnight, put into forced tapering. They went into withdrawal, which you alluded to, which is awful, 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 terrible pain and all sorts of horrible symptoms. And so people don't want to be in withdrawal. And if you take away their prescription opioids, some of them go to the illicit market, which is available. And that's a far worse place to be. And so the unintended consequence of that recommendation was It increased the number of overdoses. It increased the number of fatalities. It increased the number of people going into crisis. And so we have to be very, very cautious about the sort of, you know, unintended harms of the best intentions. And so with our work in this area, we've tried to be extremely careful. And in our latest guideline, we have our recommendations, which is to, you know, talk to patients about if they would like to attempt a trial of tapering to the lowest dose. But we make a very clear statement saying forced or involuntary tapering, no, it does not work out well. This should never be pursued. Why do we even approach people about considering a trial of tapering? It's for the reason you mentioned before, where people often will develop tolerance to these drugs over time. And if you see people in palliative care, the amounts of opioids some of them are receiving are massive. If you gave that to someone as their first starting dose for pain, they would overdose immediately. But people develop tolerance. And so what we understand about these medications is the longer they are used, for many people, they don't become as effective over time. They become less effective. They might continue to take them more because they are mitigating interdose withdrawal symptoms as opposed to achieving a specific benefit. And the way we can explore that is through a careful, voluntary, graduated reduction to see how they respond to that. And we now have at least 3 randomized control trials that have come out showing that a program of voluntary supported tapering, where patients have the ability to pause and even return or stop to a previous dose if they're not tolerating well, often appears to help people get down quite a bit in their dose, sometimes to discontinuation. So very challenging issue, very nuanced, have to be very careful not to do more harm than good despite best intentions, and be cautious about these sorts of issues.
So I'm also, I'm a physician for prescription monitoring for the province. So a lot of conversations with prescribers around this issue. And I think the biggest fear that, especially physicians that are coming from other countries, right, it's quite shocking for them to see the amount of opioid that we use in North America.
I tell them,
bring kindness to yourself and bring kindness to the patient, because it's not the patient's fault that they're on that much. This is true tolerance. Now, mind you, I'm gonna argue about one piece there that you put in there. As a palliative care physician, I'm very strategic about how I use pharmacology. And most of my patients, I don't allow them to get into high amounts of opioid, because then what it tells me is that the opioid it's not working. So a lot of our patients end up on methadone, because it's the only one that we know that does not wind up that NMDA receptor, which is what we see with opiate-induced hyperalgesia, right? Yeah. So it's I think opioids are very strategic, especially when you're using for acute pain. They should be an adjunct, in my view. We should be using multimodal. And in our pain at the end of life, obviously they become a little bit more important, but we're still it's the multimodal that becomes really important. One of the challenges I see in the chronic pain population is a couple of things, and I don't know if your research has ever looked at this, Jason. This is the last little area that I'm going to talk about, but I would love to dig into this a little bit more, is that the how I quickly realized, because my interest in methadone initially for pain, when I established my palliative care practice, I got a lot of referrals on patients of chronic pain because they were looking at whether or not methadone, but you very quickly realized that chronic pain was a different beast. But what you often find in the chronic pain population, through no fault of their own, I think if I think about the neuroimaging, it makes sense, but there's often a very high amount of immediate release opioids that are used that very often the patient does not like to be switched to long acting. And oftentimes this creates a problem around withdrawal and all kinds of other things, right? And I think what starts to happen, because we know that pain anticipation increases for patients who are living with chronic pain, that we know the changes that are happening in the brain is the brain becomes very focused on pain, which makes sense, or focused on pain, which makes sense, but it also begins to fear worsening pain. And so when it learns a tool like an opioid is going to help, it wants to feel the onset, right? And then the offset. And so often when you try and switch the patient to long acting, they hate it. They tell you they feel terrible. Yeah. And then they may be getting that energy boost too. I'm not sure. Sometimes you have to kind of tease that out a bit, which some patients do because of the effect on the brain. Doesn't mean they're getting high from it. It's just they feel more energy. And I can remember attending a conference, palliative care conference, where they were promoting oxycodone as a way to promote energy in the palliative care patient. And I was like, holy crap,
wow.
I've got to process this one. Right. Then seriously, that was the feeling because of that particular effect on brain, you know, on the brain. And I'm like, oh no, guys, that's probably not what we should be doing here. There's other ways. That's why we have steroids. That's why palliative care invented steroids. Right. Anyway, but I don't know if that is something that's in the literature, but we see that all the time. So oftentimes it's very hard to get patients. I mean, you try to link it to what they're experiencing, like especially if they're not sleeping at night because they're probably experiencing withdrawal. And a lot of times that's where the dangerous drug of benzos come in, because the patient will come to the physician and say, look, I can't sleep at night, I'm in too much pain. Mm-hmm. So they give them a benzo, and that's the bad combination, right? But sometimes if I take a third of what they're on and just put it at a long acting at night, then that seems to be more acceptable. But I'm just curious if you've ever had that experience. And that'll be the last question I'll actually ask.
So we've been trying to look very carefully at these issues. So we do have one comprehensive review looking at factors that are associated with an increased risk of non-fatal or fatal overdose when people are being prescribed opioids for chronic pain. We put that out in the Canadian Medical Association Journal a few years ago. And we did find that there was some increased signal for immediate release opioids. Now, I think the increase in I think the odds ratio was about, I'm just thinking back, I might not be exactly right, but I think it was about 1.7. So it didn't quite double the risk, but it did increase it. Now, the baseline risk of having a fatal overdose when you're prescribed opioids for chronic pain at sort of a low dose is about 1 in 1,000. And so what we find is we often want to convey the sort of absolute risk to patients and say, this is what we're talking about. This is the increase that you have. And so is there a reason to sort of try to move towards a long acting? Yes, there is. There is some support for that. Might some patients decide for whatever reason that they experience a lot of breakthrough pain? They really want to have that immediate relief? Possibly, but it should be an informed decision if that's going to happen. We are doing a review now looking at factors associated with development of opioid use disorder. So in the next 6 months or so, I should have better information to see what we can learn about that.
That's great.
But these are all sort of challenging issues. You know, you mentioned benzodiazepines as well, and they also can depress the central respiratory system, which is what we're worried about opioids doing. If you combine two things together that can have that effect, there is some increase. But benzos sometimes help people with anxiety. And if you take away that, they might rely more on opioids to manage their anxiety, which might be a worse situation. So these are complicated things. It's always a matter of saying, how much risk do we introduce by doing this? What is the benefit that's being achieved by it? Is there a better option? If there's not a better option, are the patients okay with taking that risk or not? So there's a lot of shared decision making. And in order to facilitate that, we need to give good information that people can understand to make informed choices about their care.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that sounds pretty exciting, actually. So I know this is stuff that I see clinically, and I'm trying to make sense. I'm trying to bring in, okay, well, why? Because a lot of people would say, well, they just want to get high, right? And I said, no, that's not it at all. Yeah. There is something about that immediate release that because if I do that with a palliative care patient, I mean, I very quickly realized they were different brains. If I switch from short acting to long acting, patient got very effective pain control. Mm-hmm. But I didn't see that in the chronic pain population. And I knew it had something to do with the neurobiology and also how the brain was seeing this tool as being effective and how it wanted to use it, right? It had learned that this is really the way to do it. So listen, Jason, I'm probably going to let you go now, though I don't want to. I'm going to definitely try and get you back sometime because this has been great discussion. I just one last question that I'm going to ask you. I had written it down because it's always, I have a list of 20 questions. I think I got one. It was just been too interesting a conversation. So is there any question that you wish people would ask you more about your research that they never do?
I guess the one thing that we've really been sort of embarking on sort of in a more and more serious fashion is involving patient partners in almost everything that we do. The reality is it is all but impossible to understand the experiences of someone else. And so whether we're doing a guideline, whether we're doing an evidence synthesis, whether doing a clinical trial, we're increasingly doing that. When we prepare a lot of our guidelines, we do it from a patient perspective. So we know that clinicians in general tend to place higher value on harms or risks and patients tend to place higher value on the potential benefits. And so really, it's you know, we really increasingly believe that evidence alone is not enough to inform optimal decision making, you know, in the clinic. We need to understand the role of values and preferences. And so that's a part that I think sometimes doesn't get enough attention in terms of understanding, well, why would there be a recommendation to ever consider opioids when they could result in addiction, they could result in overdose, they could result in death. And the reason is, if you look at patient values and preferences, they place a higher value on the possibility of small but important pain relief and a lower value on some of the harms when they're given that information. So this role of patient values and preferences in interpreting the evidence, I think, is something that's really critical.
And it would be really interesting to – so the part – what you say about the values, and I agree 100% that patients need to be part of this decision, the shared decision-making. But have we failed to give patients enough options other than some of these treatments? And have we failed to convey what the science is telling us about – the complexity of chronic pain, but also the tools that can help people make progress that may not be, because I know that we have to be flexible, but in my experience, a lot of the pharmacology for me is really about taking them from that high intensity of threat to moderate so I can bring in skills. Mm-hmm. And so it's really about that threat landscape and trying to get them to a place where we can bring in other skills, bring in that knowledge, because when they're in that high intensity, the brain is feeling way too much threat.
Right.
Right. Anyway, we could go on for this with this forever.
But you're right. We needed to do a lot better work in communication, a lot better work in terms of providing details. And I'd like to see more of this sort of combined approach you talk about in clinical trials. Most of the trials right now look at one treatment versus placebo. Yeah. They don't look at this staged approach that probably does represent better practice. So we need to have research that does better reflect what we think works best in practice.
Well, and I think another piece. So what we've been doing more and more in the pain clinic, which I find has been really, really interesting, is that we start to do a lot more stuff around identifying each individual threat landscape. So when we kind of use the model that looks at how the pain system works for all of us, 100% of humans, right? Unless you're one of these young, lucky people that has no, well, actually you wouldn't be that lucky if you had no, nociceptors, but that's not a good thing. I'll take that back.
People with leprosy get that. It doesn't work out well.
Exactly. So having an understanding of a very simplistic way of understanding how that threat detection system works, how pain is produced in a way that doesn't feel threatening to the patient, but then actually focusing in on the threat landscape, understanding, because a lot of people don't see, if you've got somebody with low back pain, a young female who's been trying to take care of two elderly parents, who's also trying to take care of her own family, and she can't understand why her pain is getting worse. And because she's just thinking that, okay, this is just something I got to do, right? Yeah. But she's not seeing it as a threat landscape. Then she, not to say that she can change it, but maybe she can develop some, if she identifies it as a threat, are there things that we can do to help her feel more supported?
Yep.
Like get her other family members involved, right?
Yeah.
So for me, we're doing more and more of that. And that seems to kind of shift the focus from pain to looking at, and each, because each person is going to have a very different landscape, right? That's what makes it so specific. Anyway, I'm going to let you go.
No.
And I want to get you back.
Yeah, this has been great. Thanks for the invitation. Great discussion.
I'm
so much more to do.
Yeah. Well, I'm so grateful at how open you were to, I was so excited, even because I'm part of the mentorship network as well. And Shelley says, oh, I'm going to try and get them too then. talking about this. I don't even think we talked much about the interventional paper, but I think it all fits in the same way, right?
Yeah. It's trying to figure out where the best options lie for patients and how we can best promote recovery. And it's an ongoing challenge, but I do see progress being made.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And I hope if you have something interesting to share that you'll reach out to me. I don't want to keep bugging you, but I love talking to experts like you. I can learn so much, but it also is something that I can use in the clinical setting that helps to shape, how to provide the best possible care to this patient sitting in front of me, and also have some really important discussions. So what I see is data from these studies that you're doing, and ultimately it's me and that patient trying to make a decision looking at risk and benefit with their particular biology, right? What so this is how we do it, right? Anyway,
Absolutely.
But listen, I'm gonna let you go.
Absolutely. Well, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Take care. You too now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.